Blog Talk Radio.
Join us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, and listen to us at www.naturestalkshow.com.
Hello, everyone. This is Ken McKeon. Welcome you to Nature's Talk Show. Tonight's The Fine Art of Paleontology. Joined with Ken Borman, and before we get into our show, Ken and I want to invite you to please go to naturestalkshow.com, www.naturestalkshow.com, and log into our chat room. And I want to say a special hello to Dave out there if you're joining us, or we appreciate your questions and your comments, you know. So without further ado, hello, Ken.
Good evening, Ken. How are you this fine evening?
Doing very well. The weather here is perking up here in the southwest. We're going to be getting ready to go out and do some exploration here real soon. So we're real happy about the way the weather and stuff is working out here. So how's things back your way?
Well, it's finally cold here. we didn't think we were going to have a winter there at one stage, but here in southwestern Ontario, it is finally winter. We've got a little bit of snow around, not too much at the moment, certainly a lot less than we normally have. But it's cold, but there's no precipitation. So we count our blessings.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's kind of interesting here because we're seeing here in the last 100 years or so what, well, actually for the last 10,000 years we've been seeing the Earth warming up. And one of the topics we'll discuss tonight here is global warming over the millennia. But tonight's subject, and this takes us back to the root for paleontology, Ken, and we're going to talk geology, but it's plate tectonics, you know. Since I've been a research associate at the New Mexico Museum of Natural History, and I get to go out and talk to people and meet people, you know, and they find out I'm a researcher, one of the most common questions that I'm asked is, how are fossils like seashells and marine fossils, how do they get on the top of a mountain? Do you ever run across people asking that question to you or anything?
Yes, I have, and I can remember when I was young, I used to often wonder too, you know, how did they get there? But then I had access to a set of encyclopedias when I was young, and I'm very thankful that my parents, when I asked them questions like that, they'd say, look it up in the encyclopedia. Now, I don't know if that's because they didn't know the answer, but or not, but it certainly instilled a good habit for me. So whenever I have a question now, I did research and find the answer out myself.
You know, that's interesting because I paralleled you pretty much too, except my grandparents actually bought a set of encyclopedias, and I was allowed to read them when I was very young, you know. So, it was interesting, you know, going through these. You know, I hate to say it, but I was the nerdy type, and Ken, I started from A and went to Z.
We do parallel each other, Ken.
But it was really fascinating. Now, it's kind of funny. Let's go back in the time a little bit, but not too far back. But let's talk about ancient humans here a little bit, you know. We know that people come across fossils. We see, even 35, 40,000 years ago, we see where some of our ancestors actually incorporated fossils into jewelry and stuff, you know. And I believe that these people questioned how they found these. You know, it had to, don't you think it had to just make people wonder, you know, about this, even, you know, 35, 40,000 years ago or more?
Certainly, in more recent times, of course, that's where a lot of the mythology came from too, isn't it? But they must have found all these things. They must have been more prevalent then. And I don't know. Maybe they thought they were gods.
Yeah, and well, we do know from recent myth, I guess we can say within the last few thousands of years, different cultures around the world have reported floods, et cetera, you know. And this is kind of interesting. Now, when I was a kid, I was brought up reading the story of Noah's flood. Do you remember that one, right?
Yes, I know the story.
Yeah, Yeah, it's a pretty common story, you know, and that was how the ancient explained how fossils got up on mountains. You know, they did not understand what we're going to talk about, the plate tectonics tonight here, and the forces that can actually drive and close seas and split seas apart and continents and stuff, you know. But they had to come up with an explanation, and it's when you look at the myths. Now, this is kind of funny. The one myth that we a lot of people believe today, the Noah's myth, is actually based upon an earlier story. And this is where it falls into the category of believability. The original story, and it also parallels all the other flood stories around the globe, was close to the end of the Ice Age. There was global warming was happening. The glaciers were melting. All kinds of things were happening. And have you ever heard of an epic called the Epic of Gilgamesh?
Yes, I have.
Well, for our listeners out there, I would recommend that you read the Epic of Gilgamesh. It's a very interesting story of a young man that went out and explored. He set out on a quest. And the interesting thing about this is one of the earliest writings that we have, cuneiform writings, et cetera. So it was one of the first documented. And the to me, is one of the first cases that you see in recorded history of telephone. Now, you're familiar with a game called Telephone, aren't you?
What's that, Ken? I'm not sure.
Well, when we were in school, one of the things we did, and it is called Telephone. It's where you have one person starts out with says a sentence and then whispers it into the person's next to them ear. And
all right.
The object is to see how divergent the story becomes. And this is just in a matter of minutes. You know, you can see, the topic being totally different from where it starts out. Okay? So
I know that that game, I can't remember what we call that in Australia, but we have done that. We used to do that in Cub Scouts.
Yeah. Well, I think what we see here with some of these flood stories, especially like the one that's currently thought to be true, is a total full-on case of a telephone. It's the one that some of the modern people believe how fossils are in the rocks and everything is 1,000 years younger than the Epic of Gilgamesh. And that flood story was based upon Noah. And basically what that flood story represented was a storm of the millennium. Now, have you ever heard of the storms of the millennium? I think we've mentioned them in the past, haven't we?
I don't think I'm familiar with that, Ken.
Well, we've heard of the storm of a century. You know, that's where the weather conditions are right, and only once in every 100 years or so will a major storm come through. Well, this also happens within 1,000 years. We also what we call the storm of a millennium, and this is basically what the original Noah story was based upon, was a storm of the millennium, a very large storm that came in and flooded the Euphrates, Tigris Valley, basically what is Iran and Iraq. And it caused their world, to be flooded. So when we look at around the other world stories, that's basically what we're seeing. We're seeing all these cultures are talking about their floods in their area. So did we have a worldwide flood? Well, culture-wise, no, we did not. When it comes to the rock record, no. It definitely does not show that there was a global flood that put these fossils up on the mountains. You know, there's just so many things wrong with it that it's just a story of the ancients trying to explain how, you know, they read their world, because they didn't understand the things we understand today. You know, they didn't have the tools that we have today, like radioactive dating, the ability to use GPS, and we're seeing the continents are actually moving around. We know the speeds that they're moving and stuff. So we understand today how these forces happened, you know. So I hope some of our listeners out there, you know, if they're not familiar with these geologic forces, will listen to us tonight and get a true understanding of the mad, you know, the fantastic power that's beneath our feet. So
certainly, yeah, you're correct there.
Okay, well, let's. Where do we want to start? I guess we'll start since we know now, you know, that the fossils and fossil record is not signs of a vengeful deity or you know, anything like that. But it's just the forces of the earth itself, you know, have been able to do this. Because when we look at how these fossils got up on seas, well, we're looking at a long history of the earth and these rock moving around on each other. Now, here's an interesting thing, Ken. Now, you're familiar with density.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And you do, you've probably picked up a rock, you know, that might even be a little bit smaller than another rock, but it's heavy compared to another rock. And that's because,
right.
You know, yeah, the atoms are packed together tighter, you know, they're denser, more tightly packed. Well, when we look at the Earth's crust, one of the cool things that we have is we have a major difference in density between the rocks. And kind of fascinatingly, when we look at the crust, we see that a lot of it's basalt. But when we look at continental crust, we see that it's granite. Now, the interesting thing about granite is it usually has an interesting chemical added to it called water. And this water here reacts with the minerals, makes them, I guess the granite is puffier. It's lighter. It's almost 1,000 times lighter than the underlying basalt. Did you know that?
I didn't. I knew they were both igneous rocks. I just assumed they were comparatively the same density and therefore weight. But I've never actually held a rock of basalt and a rock of granite in the same size in my hand, so I never compared the two of them.
But that's one of the real fascinating things that we learned when we studied plate tectonics. Granite is a lot lighter. It's less dense than the basalt. And that's why the granite, because it's the foam, basically. To me, it's foamy. You could describe it as foam on top of the, you know, down the planet.
Mm-hmm.
And it floats on top of the denser rock and the mantle. And that is why the continents do not sink into the earth, you know, and sink, because the granite is always lighter than the surrounding rock. So, now that's fascinating about rock, isn't it?
It is, actually. So the Canadian Shield, what would that be roughly? Do you know if that's basically granite?
You're looking at the original continental crust right there. That is it. That is the base of the continent. So when you get to go, when you do see the the Canadian Shield, you know, you're looking at way back in the time. I forget how many billions of years, but we're talking around 2.5 to 3 billion years probably old. But
that's
some of the original granite that was formed, you know, in the original continents. And
so everything, basically everything else is much newer then.
Yeah. And let's see here. Now, when the continents started forming back in the Precambrian, you know, they granite kind of had to be made. You know, it took once the planet started cooling down, different minerals start precipitating out because there had to be a time, you know, when there was during the original, I guess, the bombardment phase. You remember, you're familiar with that, I'm sure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. And a lot of heat was produced, you know, and stuff. So it had to be after that there. And after the water had also precipitated out, Once the granite started forming, you know, and started floating around on top of the basalt, the underlying crust, that's when the continents started growing, and that's when we started getting tectonics.
Mm-hmm.
Now, for our listeners, when we see a mountain, you know, I live in the shadow of the Rocky Mountains, and it's really interesting, Ken, because it's where I live is a rift valley, and it's part of exactly what we're talking about, you know, the continents moving around, and I find it hard to believe that I do live inside the valley. And basically what it is here in New Mexico, up from part of Mexico up through New Mexico and into Colorado, the continent is rifting apart, splitting apart here. And since I've lived here, it's split apart almost 5 feet, I think, between the mountains on the east side of the rift and the volcanoes on the west side.
Wow, that's a considerable distance, isn't it? Over a short period of time.
Exactly, you know, so it's like when you think about that, these continents, you know, although they're moving slow, but when you look at the size of the Earth, and the pressure underneath the crust here, you know, by the mantle, and how the plume's coming up from closer to the center of the Earth, the core, you know, these are the driving forces, and I guess probably the best example that I can give for our listeners out there, Ken, would be: have you ever cooked, done cook and serve, or cook pudding, the kind you have to cook on the stove?
Yep.
And you notice the crust on top of that.
Mm-hmm.
Well, if you don't really stir the pudding and you see that crust forming, though, you'll notice that it starts cracking and stuff as the pudding underneath, you know, roils a little bit and churns, you know. So that's what we're seeing. That's a real good anomaly, example, I guess, analog of there's crust. And so as you see the crust on the pudding moving around, that's how our crust moves around, too, because of the roiling of the convection currents of the mantle and under mantle as well. And that drives these foamy continents back and forth and around. And another interesting thing about rock is, did you know rock is plastic?
No, I didn't.
It's fascinating when you think about it, because normally, you know, you think rock's hard and brittle and breaks and everything, but when you look at rock overall, have you ever seen, been driving down the highway and you'll see where the road cuts through and you'll see curves and bends and dips in the rock?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and not very many breaks either. You know, you'll just see the, you know, the layers dipping and everything. And that's because the rock is bendable. It'll bend for a period, then it'll shear. But pressures and et cetera, it causes this rock to bend. Now, the closer, the deeper we get, and the closer the rock, you know, gets to the mantle where it's hot, it also starts melting and becoming a lot more plastic. And I believe when we look at the Canadian Shield, there's a couple places that you can see where the rock has been heated enough where it's just been shoved and pushed together and around, and I mean, it just really, how do I want to describe it?
It's like it's been folded, doesn't it?
Many times, yeah. Yeah, there you go. And almost like accordion-like, you know, and that's where the rock, you know, had been heated enough to actually semi-melt and allow it to be bent really like that. But for the most part, rock is plastic, too. And we see that when we see the mountains being built. Now, how does a fossil get on top of the mountain or on a continent? Well, let's start with the continental one here real quick, Ken.
Okay.
Now, you live in an area, I believe you've mentioned on the air here, that you have Devonian marine fossils exposed, don't you?
Yes. Yeah.
And I lived just when I was growing up as a kid, just a little bit further south than where you live, and the rocks there exposed were Silurian marine rocks. Now, how does these marine rocks get on these continents, you know, inside these continents? Well, 250 to 500 million years ago, the Earth, these areas were low places on the crust, and the seas were a little bit higher at times, so when the seas were high, they would flood the low areas. Here's an interesting thing. When I was growing up in Indiana, I think the highest point above sea level was 800 feet, and many places was lower than that. So if you had a sea level rise of 1,000 feet, you would get inundated in that area.
Wow.
But the most part, though, these areas were a lot lower than that. They were closer to sea level, so that when the seas did come in, they would just flood different areas, because there was a lot of the parts of the continents were above sea level. An interesting thing to note about the African Craton is, I believe it has never been completely inundated by marine waters.
Wow.
Yeah.
Of course.
Yeah, it's one.
From what I've read, that might change soon. I believe the Rift lakes in the middle there are actually splitting apart. That's where the continent is splitting apart, where Africa is splitting apart.
Yeah, yeah. And that's fascinating, too. See, that's exactly the same thing I'm living in here. Is a Rift Valley. Now, here's something really cool. Is it help me on here. Is it? It's right off. It's interesting. I think it's one of the arms goes up to the Red Sea, and the continent is splitting there, but the sea is flooding in. Do you remember? I can't think of that place now. Doggone, I should be able to think about it.
What is it, Ken?
I can't remember the name of that little area, but it's where the sea is flooding in. Across, you know, into the rift. Even today, we're seeing it happening, you know. But it's part of the doggone it. What do I want to say? The
Great African Rift Valley.
It's part of the African Rift Valley and the Red Sea rifting apart.
Somalia.
Yeah, they're. I think it's on the edge of Somalia there, or that area.
Right.
But at any rate, that's where we're seeing the sea rift apart, and that will eventually be flooded and have marine life in it. And especially with sea level rising, it's probably going to flood in a lot faster. So I'd be interested to see how long it takes it to fill.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, what happened in our lifetime, you know? It takes just a few feet of sea level rise.
Of course, too, Australia is... it's below sea level in the center of the continent.
Is it? Yeah.
It is.
So it would definitely be flooded over again too. But those are, you know, once again, those are natural causes by ice ages melting. You know, back in the Cretaceous period, the Earth was ice free, and we had the Western Interior Seaway that we talked about the other day on the show. You know. So now. To put the fossils on top of mountain. Now let's talk a little bit about mountain building.
Right.
Now a good analogy to mountain building is to take a throw rug and pretend like your foot is a one of the plates, and as you push your foot against the rug, you'll see it crumple and fold. Now those folds roughly are mountains.
Right.
Because as the crust pushed together, we see these mountains. Now, one of the best ones I can think of, and I was want to talk about this here, and it was the Tethys, I believe the closing of the Tethys Sea. And this is where I think a lot of the things about the fossils, too, because the fossils were found up, you know, in the Himalayas.
All right.
Okay, well, what we know now happened is as the Indian subcontinent started working its way closer and closer to the Asian continent.
Mm-hmm.
There was a seaway there called the Tethi Sea, and full of life back when it was, an active sea and all kinds of, marine life in it. But as the Indian subcontinent got closer to Asia, it started closing that sea off, and it started raising and folding the land and started shoving it up. And eventually, as the continent shoved up against the subcontinent, India, starts crashing into the Asian continent, the force of the collision is still, to this day, rising the Himalaya Mountains. And what was once the bottom of the Tethi Sea has been shoved up almost 5 to 7 miles above sea level. And but that driving force, as we mentioned, the enormous pressures that is shoving these continents together, for us puny humans, it's hard to imagine it. But when you look at the Earth, and you see how thin the crust really is and stuff, and imagine how hot it is, it's like, for me, it's easy to understand how this actually works. And there's other things, too, to help support the continental drift, too, Ken.
Actually, I've got a question for you, Ken.
Sure.
If continental drift or plate tectonics follows the laws of physics, and they do, for every action, there's an equal and opposite reaction, right? So when
mm-hmm.
when the continents hit and they push the mountains up, at some stage, they're going to get to the level where enough, do they then start retreating?
Well, this is an interesting thing. You're going to find that you're going to like this. Erosion is almost as fast as mountain building. Did you know that?
Ah, no, I didn't.
Yeah. Yeah, for the most part, it seems that as fast as the mountains build up, it's barely outgrowing erosion. They're being eaten down.
Mm-hmm.
Millimeters a year at a time on some of these mountains, freezing and thawing and freezing and thawing, and it starts working this rock. And when you look at the limestones and sandstones and stuff of the sedimentary rocks, water works its way up into the layers, and big chunks of these here things get eaten off pretty rapidly. So rocks crumble fast. It's kind of fascinating when you think about that, huh?
It is, actually, yeah.
Yeah, so that's why the mountains never outstrip much, we don't see them much higher than we do today because they get weathered down. And even as fast as, Mount Everest is growing, it's being weathered down about that fast as well.
Right. That makes sense.
Now there's another interesting thing that happens, too, where we have these continents colliding, et cetera. We have zones around the continents, too. That's called subduction zones. And as you mentioned, for every action, there's a reaction. And this is where, because the continents are so much lighter than the seafloor, most of the seafloors are made of basalt, they actually will curl down and go underneath the continents.
And thus causing the upthrust.
And that's the pressure, yeah, along the edge of the continents. That's rumpling the rug, so to speak.
It's also creating friction, isn't it?
Well, and that, basically happens is this rock, as it subducts, it starts melting. And now as we look along, along our continents here, let's talk about say here along North America, all the way down to South America, as we look at the Andes Mountains up through all the various Rocky Mountains here in North America. And one of the interesting things about these here mountains is they're loaded with active volcanoes. Now, these volcanoes, interesting enough, are usually a little bit inland, and the reason they are is that as the seafloor crust is subducted under, not only is it raising, these mountains along the edge, but it's also melting the seafloor, it's doing an interesting thing to this seafloor here, Ken, too, because it's dragging down the sediments along with it, and it takes down something else along with it, water. And what that does is this lava that's forming is a little bit lighter than the other lava. It actually comes back up, but because it's got the water in it, it makes it these volcanoes more explosive. I think it's a ratio of silica to water has something to do with that. Whether you get a flow like Hawaii, or you have volcanoes like Mount St. Helens.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So if you've got a continent that is comparatively low, that means it's been around for a long time, or it just hasn't been subducted for quite a while.
Well, you got to remember, the continents themselves aren't being subducted much.
Right, it's the plates, yeah.
Yeah, it's the plates. They go underneath the continents.
I was thinking of Australia. Like, the highest point in Australia is Mount Kosciuszko, and that's only just a bit over 2,000 meters tall.
Oh, wow.
That's it. That's our highest point. So, and I do know that Australia is a very old continent.
Yeah. Yeah, it broke off of Antarctica, I believe.
Yeah, and it's weathered. It's not holding up well due to its age.
Yeah, I believe Australia, you know, it's pretty old as well. You know, the rocks exposed there and stuff. I know there's exposures as old as lots of Precambrian stuff.
Yeah, yeah, that's right. We were talking about the Ediacaran period there few months back, weren't we?
Yeah. And low continents like that, I had a friend tell me, a geologist friend told me that the sea levels could rise several hundred feet still. You know, and there are, now when we look at the older continents, well, let's go back to the, about 3 or 4 million years ago, okay?
Mm-hmm.
3 or 4 million years ago, the Earth was a little bit warmer than it is today, even. And once again, the seas were higher. And what we see here is when we look at, like, the continent of Africa, we look at North America, like down around the coast of Louisiana, et cetera. When we look at some of these places, you know, where the people are finding, whale fossils inland, you know. And that's because these animals were actually swimming around in these shallow flooded areas along close, you know, where the continent, over these continents. But the seas never flooded completely over the continents. Just in certain areas. And once again, plate tectonics, is the reason that these areas are exposed today. Now, an interesting thing, too, it appears that when the seafloors are spreading, we know there's the Mid-Atlantic Ridge is one of the major ones. It seems to be that when it is spreading faster, and the way we can tell this, too, is an interesting thing. When you look at the magnetic readings of the rocks, you can see by the different how thick the area is of each magnetic stripping, because in the magma, as it comes up, there's iron molecules. And in the liquid rock, these iron molecules are aligned by the Earth's magnetic pole. And every time we get these different layers of magma that come up and they solidify, it records the alignment of the Earth. And we can read these bands because each one has a slightly different magnetic reading. And we've been able to see this happening in the Mid-Atlantic Ridge. We've got these barring that get older and older the further away you get from the center of the rifting.
That's quite interesting, isn't it?
Yeah.
That we can find something and relate it to that.
And we can age these too. That's what's another interesting thing, because of the radioactive elements that are locked in the seafloor there as the magma wells up. So it's really fascinating about this, you know, that we're able to tell all this by that. Yeah,
and
it's really
and
great.
It's all because of plate tectonics, is, and that explains a lot of things, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Explains the marine fossils on land, up in the mountains, anywhere on land, actually. And I've got, the chances of finding fossils offshore are fairly slight, I would think, because of the subduction and zones and everything, wouldn't it be?
Yeah, the sea floors are really young. They're just millions of years old, not hundreds of millions or anything like that. Especially the Atlantic Ocean, it's a young sea floor. It's only around 200 million years old.
Hmm.
Yeah, maybe a little bit younger. The Atlantic Ocean started forming back during the Jurassic period, when Gondwana started breaking up and South America and Africa split apart.
Well, that's comparatively recently, isn't it?
So we know real close to how young the Atlantic Ocean is. And it's slowly growing every year by so many millimeters a year.
Have we worked out if that's because which continent is retreating?
I think it's North America is the one that's moving
towards Asia.
Towards Asia, yeah.
Right.
And the Pacific Ocean is slowly closing up in places. The Atlantic is rifting. The Red Sea area is rifting. Here in New Mexico, it's rifting.
Of course, the Ring of Fire around the Pacific. Starts in New Zealand, goes up through Japan, and then down across through the Rockies, and it just misses South America, I believe. But it explains the Hawaiian Islands too, doesn't it?
Yeah, well, the Hawaiian Islands are a little bit different than what you were talking about. Ring of Fire is what I'm trying to, the term I want to think of.
Mm-hmm.
And the Ring of Fire defines the tectonic boundaries around where these plates are, the subduction and rifting zones are. We have the volcanoes, and it's beautiful, you know, how it just follows where the plates are, pulling apart and everything. Now, the Hawaiian volcanoes are a little bit different kind of deal. They're kind of what's called a plume volcano. And that's where there's a hot spot in the Earth's mantle. And as the continents are drifting across this hot spot, it tweets up these little islands. So what's really cool is the Hawaiian Islands actually record the seafloor moving across this hot spot. So the Hawaiian Islands are fantastic for that reason there, you know. They show that the plates are moving.
I believe that's the same with the Galapagos, is it?
I believe so, and also with Yellowstone. There's a series of, you can see where it's, the hot spot that makes it has erupted several times in a pattern.
So when that hot spot blows again, we're in trouble.
That's going to be an earth shaker.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's going to make the Earth ring when that one explodes. So, but that's a super volcano, and you know, one of these days we'll have to have a show where we talk about volcanoes.
Yeah, that'll be interesting, I think.
Yeah, they're fascinating things, and there's a lot we know about volcanoes. And I, of course, one of the interesting things here is I live about 70 miles from one of the largest calderas on the Earth, called the Jemez Caldera, big enough that it's visible from space.
Very nice.
Oh, it's cool. I love going up there inside the caldera itself. Actually, here in New Mexico, we got several calderas, so And they're the result of continental drift. The continents here, here where it's rifting, it's kind of interesting because the Manzano, I live just east or west of the Manzano Mountains here in New Mexico, central New Mexico.
Mm-hmm.
And it's kind of cool because even though there's mountains shoved up here, for the most part, what's happening is here on the west side of the mountains is we're actually lower because it's sunk, and that makes the mountains appear higher than when you're on the east side of them here in this particular part. So these mountains here are formed by not mountains, you know, being crushed together, but by an area being pulled apart, and we get these mountainous areas. Now, something that's kind of cool is when we look at the Manzano Mountains here, Ken, the basal part of the mountains itself is what we call quartzite. It's a pre-Cambrian quartzite. And the cool thing about it, this whole big mountain area through here, the Manzano Mountains that run for many miles, they're actually, they border the continental granite and their pre-Cambrian beach sands.
Wow.
Yeah. So here we are seeing beach sands way here in inland here in North America, almost 1,000 miles from the Pacific Ocean is where I live.
but then again, as we outlined last week too, where you live now would be very close to beachfront property with the inland sea.
Yeah, you'd have got
as well.
You'd have been on the western part of the North American continent at the time. What'd we call it? Laramidia?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah, you'd have been on the here and living in Laramidia with Tyrannosaurus Rexes and stuff. I think I like it today better. Closest we got to a T Rex are roadrunners. But it's, you know, but the continental plate tectonics, though, has shown us a lot of things here, you know, how the continents are formed, how mountains are formed, how oceans and seas are formed, you know. So it's really a beautiful fact of nature, I think.
But really, the concept has only been around it for 100 years, hasn't it? And really only widely accepted in the last 50 or 60.
Yeah, it's it's interesting how you know, for many years, especially hundreds and thousands of years ago, the Earth was thought to have been solid. You know, it was as it always was.
Or hollow.
What's that?
Or hollow.
Or hollow. Yeah. Oh,
don't
the hollow world.
Forget those stories. Mm-hmm.
Oh my gosh, that's an interesting one. I'm trying to. No, I'm losing myself here.
Sorry, I threw you with that comment.
No, I lost my train of thought. Oh well. as we move on. But actually, we're getting through this pretty quick, Ken.
It's not too bad. Now, right, that we've explained how fossils get on top of mountains, and how fossils of obviously sea creatures are found in the interiors of continents. Now, you've explained to me and our listeners how the chances of finding fossils offshore is very remote because all the rock is so young there, basically, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What other paleontology-associated things can we explain with geology? Well, I guess sandstone, that's your best thing for finding fossils in, isn't it?
Well, here's an interesting thing we can that we have here. Let's take this area here in New Mexico for an example. as we look at the rocks. Now, here, one of the interesting things, Ken, that you will probably really enjoy is I actually hunt fossils, are you ready for this, along the ancestral Rocky Mountain orogeny. Okay?
Wow. Mm-hmm.
Now, what this is here at this time, plate tectonics had formed a supercontinent Pangaea.
Mm-hmm.
And New Mexico here was inland. Well, it was along the equator, for starters. We were just, I think, for the most part, where I live now here, it was close to 10 degrees north of the equator. It actually was a little bit south, drifted through the Devonian, up through the Permian period, into, and then we're up here at 35 degrees now, north latitude.
Mm-hmm. Right.
That's where we drifted to. But back when this area here was close to, well, 250 million or 300 million years ago, well, actually started in the Devonian period, the plates subduction zone here started forming these barrier islands along the western coast of Pangaea. And these eventually got tectonically raised higher to where several major uplifts were formed. And here in New Mexico, they were separated at times by water, marine water, and other times they were joined. But we have what we call the Pedernal uplift, which was from the bottom of the state to about two-thirds of the way up the state is how long it was. And only not too many miles wide, maybe about 40, 50 to 100 miles at its widest. Up mm-hmm. north, we had the Uncompahgre uplift, which is another bigger mountain island. Then to the west of here, we had another big island called the Zuni Defiance uplift. And the Zuni Defiance was part of New Mexico, part of Arizona, and part of Utah. The Uncompahgre uplift covered a big chunk of Colorado and a part of northern New Mexico. The Pedernal was all completely inside of New Mexico. And it is along these early Rocky Mountain uplifts. Now, these were being formed by the very same plate tectonics. The Pennsylvanian rocks that was the sea at the time here, they were actually the mountains at the time for parts of this. Also, parts of the granite continent was breaking through, and some of the Permian stuff that we have is laid down directly on basal continental rock, the granite. So what I'm looking for here, my research I do for New Mexico and the Permian, we're looking basically along an erosional floodplain that as the tectonics and the glaciation move back and forth, we would have seas come in, we got a little bit of marine stuff, then we have terrestrial stuff, and that's what we're finding our Dimetrodons in, these terrestrial layers where the seas retreated. And but we see the rocks that form the, what we research in, the Abbo Formation, all come mm-hmm. from these uplifts. And they were the original Rocky Mountains that eroded down and eventually were buried by Triassic times. They were gone.
Now, the Dimetrodons found in Texas are different to the ones that you're finding, right?
Yeah, New Mexico so far has found, we found our own species. And we're also finding the oldest species here. And once again, this is from plate tectonics. When we look at the Dimetrodon evolution, as we see here across Pangaea, we see that the very oldest Dimetrodon fossils come from deposits off the Zuni Defiance uplift. Now, that was one of the westernmost islands on Pangaea. It was had several, 100 miles of sea separating from some of the other uplifts.
Right.
But it appears that during one of the tectonic events, either when tectonic activity was raising the area or one of the glacial eustatic events when down in Gondwana, there were glaciers forming, and that sucked a lot of the water up, that the Zuni Defiance was connected to the rest of Pangaea. And that's when I believe Dimetrodon was able to immigrate west, towards the east, across tropical Pangaea. Because when we find Dimetrodon fossils in Texas, they're actually almost 10 million years younger than the oldest Dimetrodon fossils we're finding here in New Mexico.
Okay. Now,
yeah, big difference.
when we had Dr. Becker on our show, he was saying that, well, he's working in Colorado now, isn't he?
Yes.
So that's a different uplift, and he's finding Dimetrodon there too, isn't he?
Yeah, what that is that he's on the north side of the Uncompahgre uplift. I'm on the south side.
Ah, right. Okay.
Yeah.
That makes sense then.
Yeah, so basically the deposits he's finding are coming from, and also probably part of the Pangaea continent itself by the time you get up to that area. But, yeah, for the most part, that's where what he's seeing. And once again, the Dimetrodons are finding up there don't appear to be still as old as the one we're finding found here in New Mexico.
Mm-hmm.
So, but that's continental drift. That's the plate tectonics that form these uplifts where these animals evolved.
It is a fascinating subject, isn't it?
It is. It's the driving force of the Earth. It is the Earth's heartbeat.
Mm-hmm.
So, well, that about covers what we can cover tonight on the tectonics, I think, Ken.
Excellent. I think it's been an entertaining show and certainly an educational one for me. I hope our listeners think so too. I'm sure they do.
Yeah, I do recommend going out and getting a good geology book to delve more into plate tectonics because there's a whole lot more about it. I mean, really, different things about, all the different things we talked about, you can really go into it even deeper. Talking about different minerals and faults and all kinds of things and stuff, and the driving forces, plate dynamics, things about the Earth's rotation, how that reflects on it, just all kinds of these different things that I would recommend reading up more if you want to find out more about plate tectonics and, how the mountains, why the fossils are where they are. And you remember, it wasn't some upset spirits in the past, but just the good old Earth doing what the good old Earth does. It moves around.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
Yeah, it's kind of fascinating when you think about it.
It is. Have you decided what we're going to talk about next week yet, Ken?
I've kind of had a couple of ideas, but I haven't formed anything really solid. Do you have something you'd like to talk about, Ken?
I haven't got anything just off the top of my head. We'll have a discussion in the next day or two, and we'll come up with something and make sure it's posted up, eh?
Yeah, that we will, because once again, we'll take our listeners onto a journey into the past, and we'll see if we can come up with some really cool creatures. There's so much in the past to talk about. I mean, we got 4.5 billion years worth, so.
That's right.
That's a lot of life and a lot of things, So, we'll come up with something really interesting, maybe something kind of obscure that might be kind of fun back in the day, So.
Sure.
We'll see what we can do there. So, all right. Well, let me see here. I got my little thing announcements here. And
mm-hmm.
We'll let everybody know that, we do want you to follow us on Twitter, Facebook, and iTunes. We want you to please go to www.blogtalkradio.com/NTS and click on our follow button there. Also, follow us on our website, www.naturestalkshow.com. We do have a PayPal button on the website if you want to help donate money to the show to keep it going, because Ken and I both love bringing you this information about nature. And I know Mary and Tom do as well. Yeah, it's too much fun,
Don't forget, though, we have exciting news, don't we, Ken Borman?
Yes, we do. I've been waiting patiently.
We actually have
some exciting news.
Well, actually, for our listeners out there, for some of them that hope to meet Ken and me and Mary and Tom and stuff, is I'm going to be in Canada third weekend of May, visiting with Ken Borman and our KOAC friends and doing some talks on the evolution of the killifish family. So you definitely want to, if you can get up to Canada, London, Ontario, join us for that their convention that weekend. And I'll be happy to sign artwork and say hey. But I'm also going to be at Labor Day or Memorial Day weekend up in Denver, Colorado. Ken, I'm going to try to meet Dr. Backer up there.
That'll be great.
And but I'm definitely going to stop in and visit Chenoa.
Chenoa, too, yeah. I was just going to say that.
Yeah, so I'm definitely going to give her a holler before I go up there and stuff and take some time and do a little fossil collecting up there as well. But I'll be doing, once again, a talk on the evolution of fishes. So stop in. You'll hear more about the AK, American Killifish Association National Convention in Denver as closer we get to that. And join me up there, too, and I'll be happy to say hi and sit down and talk paleontology, fossil fish, or anything else.
Yep,
so,
Mary's going to say something now.
Yeah.
I believe.
Ben Borman and his lovely wife, Lisa, have never met either one. And I are going to launch Nature's Talk Show live at the NEC convention in April. And we are super excited about that. Ken's going to be there along with his wife. Tom and I are going to be there. We're going to be doing live. We're going to be hitting up vendors and all kinds of things. So I hope that you all mark that on your calendar. When is that, the 8th through the 10th, Ken?
8th through the 10th of April, yep.
So, come
meet.
It's in Connecticut, I believe. Am I right?
Rocky Hill, Connecticut.
So, please, come meet Tom and Ken and Ken McKeon, he cannot join us because he is planning that trip to Canada. Tom and I will not be going to Canada, but we have been invited already to a couple other conventions. So, and part of that PayPal thing is to help fund our trips here. So you guys consider helping us raise the, for me, I'll be flying, so that's all going to cost me big bucks. And Tom lives close to Connecticut, so he'll be driving there. And I think Ken and his wife were driving down from Canada. So come say hi to us at the NEC convention in April, okay? That's all I have to say, Ken and Ken.
All right. Well, that's about all I have to say, too, you know. Ken, thank you very much for joining me again tonight. This is a blast.
It's always a pleasure. Always.
Yeah. Oh, this is too much fun. So I hope our listeners enjoyed talking geology tonight. Next week, Ken and I are going to get something cool.
And don't forget, too, if you have any questions, feel free to type them out in the chat room on naturestalkshow.com, and we'll get back to you. If you've got any show ideas, drop us a line, let us know, and we'll put a show together on whatever topic you would like to hear.
Yeah, there you go. Fantastic. All right, then. Well, listen, thanks, everybody. We're glad you joined us tonight, and we'll talk to you next time here on Nature's Talk Show. Good night, everybody.
Good night for me.
Join us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, and listen to us at www.naturestalkshow.com.